The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, and welcome to the seventh reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. I'm Debbie Robertson. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In chapters 21 through 25, Jane and Mario finally were able to marry, 16 years after Mario first heard Jane's voice reciting a poem in the fourth grade. They moved in with Mario's parents, which proved to be a thorn in Jane's side, for Mario's mother was very critical of Jane and quite doting on Mario. A year later, much to Jane's relief, they get their own apartment, and Jane flourished at being the good housekeeper she longed to be. They had a baby, a girl, and they both reveled in being proud parents. But then, alas, they moved into a house. But why, alas? Mario's parents lived right next door, and Jane again was under Mario's mother's steely eyes. Now we continue with The Sound of Her Voice. Chapter 26, Quick-Witted. When they were married, some people, including their relatives, didn't think that two blind people could manage. Who would take care of them? How could they raise any children by themselves? Jane was determined to keep both her house and children clean. What would people say if her children wore dirty clothes? That poor blind Mrs. Peroni doesn't know that her children are dirty. She must not be fit to raise them. Jane feared that child welfare would decide that she was an unfit mother because of her blindness, so she made sure that her children always wore clean clothes and went out with washed faces. One spot on a blouse did matter. As Anne grew older, Jane asked her to check everyone's clothes for spots. "Anne, do I have any spots on my dress? How about Johnny's pants?" Jane bought play clothes for each child, along with school clothes and Sunday outfits. It was easier to keep the nicer clothes for dress occasions, and she worried less about spots on the play clothes. She knew that children need to play and would get dirty, but they must put on clean clothes the next day. Likewise, Jane had house dresses that she wore only around the house. She always wore an apron, which saved her dress from a lot of food spills. But whenever she went to the grocery or anywhere out in public, Jane changed into a good dress fresh from the laundry that she knew was spotless. Despite the naysayers, Jane proved to be a competent mother. She did all the diapering, washing, cooking, feeding, cleaning, nursing, and sharing discipline with Mario. But there was one thing that Jane couldn't do for her children. She couldn't cut their fingernails. When Anne was a very young baby, Jane tried to cut her nails with a small pair of scissors. She cut too deeply, making the finger bleed and Anne cry out in pain. Jane felt terrible and resolved to ask a sighted person for help. Her sister-in-law, Virginia, had four children. Jane reluctantly asked her. Virginia stopped by the house occasionally and trimmed them for her. Jane was grateful but wished that she could do it and not be forced to rely on someone else. When Anne was old enough to do her own nails, it became her job to trim her younger siblings' nails. She didn't complain about the extra chore, although every time Anne got the scissors and sat down with John, Jane felt a stab of sadness that she couldn't perform such a simple task. Jane trudged up the wooden basement steps, a heavy basket of wet sheets propped against her hip. 18-month-old John followed closely behind, hanging on to the hem of her skirt. It was a warm spring day, perfect for drying the load of sheets. She didn't yet have a dryer and used the clothesline strung across the backyard to dry their laundry. "Johnny, I'm going to hang these sheets up. You come with me. Go find your truck." Jane heard his little shoes running on the sidewalk, then stop when he found the truck. She listened as he imitated truck sounds and rolled the red metal toy on the cement. Jane set about picking up the sheets and fastening them to the line with wooden clothespins. Minutes later, she realized she didn't hear her son anymore. "Johnny, where are you? What are you doing?" When he didn't answer, Jane became alarmed. Trying not to panic, she called out again, a note of fear in her voice. "Johnny, answer me!" Seconds later, Jane heard the toddler giggle. It sounded as though he was over by the Cole Street fence. Ducking under the clothesline, Jane walked toward the fence, hoping that he was still inside the yard. "Johnny, where are you?" Jane tried to keep her voice calm while hoping that his answer would guide her to him. She reached the fence and, to her horror, found that the gate was open. How would she find him now? He could be anywhere, or worst of all, the street that was only feet away. Jane's heart was pounding. She knew that if she tried to chase him, he'd just run into the street and away from her. Jane stood still for a few moments, then said, "Well, Johnny, I have to go in. I'll leave the gate open. You can come in when you're ready." She turned around and walked back into the house. When he saw her go inside, he had no interest in staying out alone. Much to her relief, Jane heard the tapping of his little feet as he ran on the cement sidewalk toward the back door. "Mommy, where are you?" called the toddler. "I'm right here, Johnny," she said as she opened the screen door for him. Deliberately going off and leaving a very young child by the street was the hardest thing that she had to do as a parent, but it was the only way she knew to get him back inside to safety. Chapter 27. Can't Win. Anne and John were healthy, but like other children, they sometimes became ill with childhood sicknesses such as measles and chickenpox, which were not preventable by vaccine in the 1950s. Jane didn't need a thermometer. She could tell by touching the child's forehead and body if they had a fever. Unusually cranky behaviors were another clue that something was wrong. She gave extra fluids and rocked the sick one to sleep while waiting on their pediatrician, Dr. Young, to stop by the house after office hours. While there was little he could do to cure an illness, it was comforting to hear his reassuring words. When the children were very young, Aletta often accompanied them on the bus to Dr. Young's office for regular checkups. Jane never left the house alone and needed Aletta to help her navigate while managing two children. But when Anne turned 5, Jane realized that she could walk with Anne and hold 2-year-old John's hand. She didn't need her critical mother-in-law to go with her. Anne was a careful guide, and Jane felt safe with her. Riding on the bus to Dr. Young's office for an appointment, Anne became aware of 2 women staring at them. She heard them talking about her mother. "Well, at least the children can see. How does she manage? I can't imagine. She must have a lot of help. There's no way she can do it alone. How can she change diapers? What if that cute little boy runs away from her? She'll never be able to catch him. And he could get hit by a car. I know, they look pretty clean. How does she know if they're dirty?" Anne looked at her mother's face. She could tell by the way that her lips were pressed together that her mother was angry to be talked about as if she were also deaf and stupid. Minutes later, the bus came to their stop, and with relief, the family got off. Anne was angry for her mother and never forgot the overheard conversation. Although they lived next to Mario's parents, Jane did not want to depend on them for babysitting or help with the children. She rarely took them for visits, although as they got older, they often went by themselves to grandmother for cokes or candy. Jane never bought soft drinks, or kept candy in the house, so the children considered it a great treat to run next door for the forbidden sweets. The extra calories eventually became a problem when John was 11 and gaining too much weight. Jane asked Aletta to stop giving him the treats, but she refused. Jane was furious. She complained to Mario, who explained that Italian mothers like to spoil their sons. Jane didn't buy that explanation, but was powerless, knowing that he wouldn't confront his mother. Aletta further offended Jane when she criticized Jane's new hairstyle. She was deeply hurt, and yet when she told Mario, he replied, "That's the way she is. She doesn't ever go to the hair salon. I don't think she's ever cut her hair." His explanation did not mollify Jane. When men's wash and wear shirts became available, Jane was thrilled. She wouldn't have to spend so much time and energy ironing. Aletta did not approve of permanent press clothing and implied that she was not being a good wife if she didn't iron Mario's shirts. Jane was not pleased with her implication, but didn't argue. Her resentment toward her critical mother-in-law grew, and while Jane rarely argued with Aletta, she also never forgot the painful barbs. Much as she liked depending upon her mother-in-law, Jane still needed some help with the grocery shopping or buying clothes. One cold January day, Aletta and Jane took 5-year-old Anne and 2-year-old John out shopping. When they arrived home, John had a dirty diaper, and Jane was in a hurry to get him changed. Anne took off her coat, while Jane quickly pulled off John's little blue coat and handed it to Aletta. Jane carried John into the bathroom, and Aletta hung the coat to dry on a wall sconce with a hot electric light bulb and went into the kitchen. Minutes later, smoke began curling from under the coat. Jane dashed into the living room, frantically calling, "I smell smoke! What's burning?" Anne looked up and saw a flame pop out from the coat. "Johnny's coat is on fire!" Astounded, Anne stood back as she watched Aletta grab the coat and throw it to the floor and stomp out the fire. Jane was angry and frightened. "How did it catch fire?" she demanded, frowning in Aletta's direction. "I thought it might dry faster on that light bulb. I didn't think it would catch fire," said Aletta. "How could you do that? You're an adult. You should have known better than to hang a coat over a light bulb," Jane said as she reached down to pick up the coat. The smell of burning wool still hung in the air. She fingered the material, finding a large hole. "It's ruined. I'll have to buy another one," she said in a disgusted tone. "You could have burned the house down. You scared me to death when I smelled smoke." Shaking her head and with her heart still pounding, Jane turned and said, "Anne, you go and play with John while I finish cleaning up the bathroom." Later that night, Jane told Mario about the near disaster. "Now, Jane, don't be so hard on her. Mom was just trying to help. She put out the fire. No harm done." "Don't placate me. You weren't there. If the house had burned, they'd have said that a blind woman caught her house on fire and we're not fit to raise those kids. I have to worry about things like that. Your mother didn't. She could see, and nobody would have criticized her. And now I have to buy John another coat. I doubt she'll pay for it, and she knows that money is tight for us. It just makes me so mad." Mario heaved a large sigh and said, "I don't know what I can do. It doesn't seem that I can please either of you. I feel as though everything I do is graded, and nothing I do measures up to her expectations. I can't relax around her, Mario. I've always have my guard up. She watches everything that the kids or I do. She doesn't hesitate to let me know that I'm deficient in many ways. What can I say back to her? She's my mother-in-law, and I can't argue with her. I just bite my tongue and try not to spend any more time with her than I have to. I do appreciate that she helps me shop and will babysit if I absolutely need a sitter, but you know I don't like to ask her. I don't want to owe her any favors." Aletta never offered to buy a new coat for John, and Mario didn't mention the incident to his mother. Tensions between the two women continued. Jane rarely invited Aletta and Antonio over for dinner, and the family went next door to celebrate Easter or other special occasions only when Charles and his family were there. Aletta did not stop by for informal visits or coffee, although Antonio occasionally went over to fix something at the house. Mario continued his nightly visits, irritating Jane, who would have appreciated help with the baths and getting the children into bed. Jane had no one nearby to provide emotional support and few close friends. Her own mother had died just before Anne was born, and her sisters lived over an hour away. She couldn't telephone Ruth or Irma, as long distance was typically used only for emergencies or to spread big news, not to let off steam. She didn't feel comfortable writing about her problems in letters to her sisters. The letters weren't private, and by the time she had a chance to write, her anger had cooled off. Jane stuffed her feelings and continued to bite her tongue, but the suppressed anger and resulting stress would come at a price to her body, as she later developed chronic illnesses that caused unrelenting pain. Chapter 28. Glass Eyes. Shortly after noon, on a cool spring day in 1947, Jane heard small footsteps running up the front steps and the front door slam. She sighed with relief. Anne was safely home from preschool. Although Anne was now 4 and had been walking alone to and from school for a year, Jane still wished that she could accompany her. It was yet another example of something she couldn't do for her child. But walking alone didn't seem to bother Anne. She cheerfully left the house every morning and happily returned in time for lunch. "Hi, Anne. How was your day at school?" asked Jane as she helped remove Anne's red sweater. "It was okay," she replied. Anne looked up at her mother's face and studied her eyes for the first time. "Mom, why is your eye so big?" "Well, my eyes were sick when I was born. One eye just got a lot bigger. Why do you ask?" "Well, Nancy said that your big eye was ugly and scary. She wanted to know why it was so big. I told her to leave me alone." "Oh, dear, I'm sorry that happened." "Don't pay attention to her. Nancy is stupid. What's for lunch?" While Anne didn't appear to be emotionally upset by the classmate's question, Jane was embarrassed and horrified that her daughter already was being teased. She didn't want Anne to suffer because of her blindness or the appearance of her eyes. Jane remembered looking into the bathroom mirror as a young child. With the limited vision that remained, she had stared at her bulging eyes, hating them. She ignored her fair skin, rounded chin, plump cheeks, and short brown hair, convincing herself that her swollen eyes made her ugly. She stared at the fuzzy reflection, angry that she couldn't do anything to change it. Her classmates teased her and told her that someday her eyes would pop out of her head. Whenever she was out in public, even with faint vision, she could still see people staring at her. Jane felt ashamed of her eyes and was embarrassed to be singled out. As an adult, completely blind, she felt the stares and endured hearing whispers about her appearance. Jane wanted to look like a normal woman. She had tried to hide behind pairs of eyeglasses and even worn them for her high school graduation picture. Later, she admitted to herself that people could still see her misshapen eyes through the clear lenses. She stopped wearing glasses. She was only fooling herself. Ever since Jane had read that it was possible to remove her eyes and replace them with artificial glass eyes, she had longed for the day when they could afford the surgery. Mario, while supportive of her desire to get glass eyes, always worried about having enough money to pay for the operation. She vowed to wait no longer. Jane decided that afternoon to have the surgery. The first child at school had asked questions, and there would be others. It was time to rid the offending eye. Perhaps she could save money by having only the largest eye removed. It would be better than nothing. She found a doctor in Indianapolis who suggested that both eyes be removed. He told her about artificial glass eyes and how they would make her look normal. She could even choose the eye color. Jane was excited about the prospect and anxious to have the operation. She scheduled the surgery for the following month. Jane was surprised when Aletta offered to take care of Anne while she was in the hospital and gratefully accepted. In the mid-1940s, patients were routinely hospitalized for at least a week after surgery. Jane didn't mind being in the hospital for that long. She enjoyed the rest and not having to worry about cooking or doing the housework. After she had recovered from the operation, Anne, Mario, and Jane took the train to Chicago for her appointment to be fitted for her first pair of artificial eyes. Anne was fascinated by the rows of glass eyes lined up neatly on color by color on trays. She stared at the unseeing eyes and felt a shiver, yet was fascinated by the many sizes and shades of brown, blue, and green looking up at her. She anxiously watched the man work to get the correct eye size for her mother. Jane's relaxed and calm demeanor comforted Anne. This was simply the next step to fulfilling her mother's dream, and no pain was involved. The man asked Jane what color eye she wanted. She paused while trying to visualize what she would look like in brown, hazel, or blue eyes. Since left eye was ugly, surely people stared at it as they did at hers. But Mario said no. allowing no further discussion, he absolutely would not consider glass eyes. Why he wanted to keep his eye, maintaining that he could have greatly improved his appearance. Perhaps if Mario had been more forthcoming with his memories of his traumatic childhood surgery, Jane could have been more sympathetic for sensing even a bit of light. During his lifetime, men didn't admit to being as sensitive as women to physical imperfections. But most importantly, as he told one of the ray of light would be extinguished if his eye were removed. The chapter ends with a letter that Jane wrote to her sister, Irma.
Sunday afternoon. Dear Irma, a more appropriate time to write to that beloved sister of mine I could never find. Anne is taking her usual long nap, and Mario is in Indianapolis handling a meeting which concerns our old school alumni. Incidentally, they are letting us have a meeting this spring. I received both your letters this week. The hospital forwarded the Braille one, so your efforts were not for nothing. In fact, I enjoyed it very much, and I could read every word, too. Your other letter came yesterday. Thanks for both of them. Just keep it up, and maybe I'll improve my correspondence, too. I think about you often, but I don't always feel like writing. Now that this operation is over, I believe I'm going to have better health than ever before. I didn't realize what a constant burden that large eye was. The doctor said I would be much better off now. If you are worrying about me, please don't. I didn't suffer one bit. There was no pain whatsoever. In fact, this was easier and more pleasant than having my tonsils out. They didn't give me either, just a shot of something in the vein in my right arm and put me to sleep. I felt nothing until I awakened hours later. It was so simple, and I had no shock at all, so I really had a fine time at the hospital. The food was very good, and there was plenty. I had nice roommates, and the nurses were as sweet as any I have ever met. I came home last Sunday, and for a few days I took it easy, but now I'm back on the job again. Pop and Elvis canned last Tuesday and said they would come down soon and bring you along. I couldn't get them to say just when. It seems to depend on the weather. I had a card from Ruth while I was in Indianapolis. She said Paul had run into a tree and their car was in the garage again, and that no one was hurt. Yesterday, I went back to Indianapolis for a checkup. The eye had healed already, so that I can go to Chicago any time. We're writing tomorrow for an appointment. If they will okay it, we will probably go this Friday and have the fitting done Saturday morning. If that time isn't available, we will try to get in on Monday morning. If the folks should decide to come down, be sure to have them call first. Must close now and get busy. Write soon. With love, Jane. Chapter 29. Mario's Career. Charles, Mario's adored older brother, had been elected city court judge in 1943. Nearing the end of his term, he decided that his law practice was so busy that he would not run for re-election. Spurred by the vacancy, Mario reasoned that if Charles could be a city judge, he could be a city judge too. It was a part-time position in the morning, enabling him to practice law in the afternoon. The idea of a steady income was appealing, and Mario hoped that the publicity from the campaign would help his law practice, as it had helped Charles's. Mario was untested in politics, but hoped that having the same last name would help him win a few votes. It was an easy decision to enter the 1947 race, though it proved to be a challenging year for Mario. He was now responsible for Jane and two children under 5 years old. He constantly worried about having enough money to pay the bills, and now he would have to pay for a campaign. Mario was extremely careful about paying for his own campaign expenses and did not want to be beholden to any special interest group or person. Keeping his integrity and reputation for his honest legal practice was of paramount importance to him. Running for re-election meant that he attended innumerable Democratic Party bean dinners and meetings, keeping him from spending evenings with his family. He had been a popular speaker since beginning his law practice and rarely turned down an invitation to speak to Boy Scouts, church groups, or civic clubs. He was comfortable talking about his seeing eye dog and how he managed as a blind person, but he knew that the public would question how a blind person could be a judge. Through innumerable meetings, talks, interviews, and occasional newspaper advertisements, he worked hard to gain the voters' confidence. Mario anxiously awaited the returns on election night downtown at the Democratic Party headquarters. His fears turned to elation as the vote showed that he'd not only beat his opponent, but had garnered more votes than anyone on either side of the ballot. With a new confidence, he began his fall campaign. He needed to convince not only his opponent's supporters, but the Republicans also to vote for him. About a month after the primary election, Mario was at home and decided it was time to take Carla out for a walk. He went upstairs, calling her name. She didn't respond, surprising Mario. Normally, she'd be excitedly moving about, thumping her tail against the doorway or wall to greet him. His foot bumped into her. He reached down and discovered that Carla was dead on the floor next to his bed. Mario was shocked. The 8-year-old dog had not shown any signs of being ill. Heartbroken at the loss of his trusted companion of 7 years, the following morning Mario called the seeing eye and reported the sad news. Having found life-changing freedom with Carla, he knew that he needed to get another dog. He signed up for the next class. While the classes were free, he lost the income from his practice for 3 weeks and had to pay for his traveling expenses. He felt bad about leaving Jane alone with Anne and baby John, but was comforted that his parents and Charles lived close by in case she needed help. Still grieving Carla, Mario traveled alone by train to Morristown, New Jersey. He was soon matched with a large German shepherd named Baron. Although he was experienced working with the dog, Baron was much younger than Carla and had his own personality. The training took about 3 weeks, as Mario and Baron had much to learn about each other and needed to develop a bond between them. Once the instructors were convinced that they were a safe team, Mario and Baron were cleared to go home. They arrived back in Muncie in mid-July 1947, and Mario began planning his fall election campaign. His intelligence and integrity, along with the numerous speeches, newspaper articles, and advertisements proclaiming his capabilities, helped propel Mario to victory. Having a popular brother as a former city court judge also helped his campaign. Since they had the same last name, Mario laughingly said, "People didn't vote for me, they voted for my brother." Mario received the second highest number of votes on the Democratic ticket and was sworn into office on January 1, 1948. He was 33 years old. Mario knew he had a lot to prove, not only as a young judge, but as a blind one. Many people openly wondered how he could be a judge if he couldn't see. Mario used his Braille typewriter to take notes and had a bailiff to maintain order. Since he couldn't see a defendant's facial expressions, he devised alternative ways to get cues. He usually didn't have jury cases, so he kept the witness chair facing him, close to the bench. He created 2 questions to assess the defendant's honesty. Did what the accused have to say make sense? What was his physical reaction? Mario knew that if a person had nothing to hide, he would generally open his mouth and speak clearly. A dishonest defendant usually wouldn't look directly at the judge, instead turning his head or looking down. Mario could tell by the way the accused's voice projected which way he was looking. He also kept the witness chair in need of oil. If the questions embarrassed the person or he wasn't telling the truth, he often began squirming, which caused the chair to squeak. The amount of squeaking correlated with the defendant's discomfort and cued the judge to consider that the defendant may be lying. Mario was aware that there was no definitive way to know if a person was lying, so he usually found other evidence or witnesses that helped him to make a final judgment. The inmates at the jail spread a rumor that a person could figure out the way Judge Peroni would rule by watching Barron's tail. If it swished back and forth, supposedly the judge would find you guilty. There was no truth to that, of course, but Mario laughed at the jailhouse story. He handled a variety of cases in court, including intoxicated driving, traffic violations, domestic violence, assault and battery, and other minor offenses. He assessed fines and didn't hesitate to send someone to jail if he thought they deserved it. The newspapers covered his decisions daily. People were curious how he would do as the first blind judge in Muncie. Although news coverage of his decisions was favorable and his colleagues seemed to approve of his work, he knew that his every move was on display, both in and out of the courtroom. The only place he could relax was at home, out of the public eye. Chapter 30, Not a Match. Preoccupied with his career and community activities, Mario didn't notice that Barron was becoming very attached to baby John. Every evening, Jane secured John in his high chair and gave him small pieces of meat and vegetables for dinner. Barron sat next to him, ready for the boy to start the game. John took a bite of meat and held it over to the side of his high chair. Barron very carefully took it out of his fingers, never touching or biting him. John smiled but didn't laugh. Neither dog nor boy made a sound. They were so quiet that Mario wasn't aware of the game until one evening when he left Barron's metal collar and the dog tags on, he heard it rattle as Barron took a bit of meat from John's outstretched hand, triggering a suspicion that the dog was doing something forbidden. That ended their food game. Mario decided not to allow Barron into the kitchen during meals because the seeing eye had emphasized never to feed a dog at a table. Dogs are notorious for begging, and the seeing eye did not want their dogs to be ill-behaved at home or in public. Mario soon became aware that when John was sleeping, Barron would go over and lie by the crib, guarding him. As John toddled around the house, Barron followed him. While Mario was aware that Barron seemed very attached to John, it never occurred to him that a problem could be developing with the dog. One late summer day, two of the older neighborhood girls, Shirley and Mary Ellen, were playing with Anne and John on the step by the front sidewalk. Barron and Mario went out to make sure that they weren't too close to the street. Just as they were approaching, Mary Ellen picked up the toddler and handed him to Shirley. Barron lunged at Shirley, who screamed, "Ow! He bit me!" Mario instinctively jerked Barron's leash and held him back. "What? Barron bit you? Where did he get you?" "He bit my ear, and it's bleeding," cried Shirley. "I'm so sorry. I can't believe that Barron bit you. Anne, help me bring John inside. I'll tie Barron down and come right back out. I'll bring you a clean washcloth for your ear." Shaken, Mario and the children climbed the front porch. "Mom, Barron bit Shirley," Anne loudly announced upon entering the living room. "What? Oh, no." Jane came hurriedly from the kitchen. "Is she bleeding?" "Yes, but I don't think her ear will fall off. That's where he bit her," said Anne. "Anne, watch John while I get something to stop the bleeding." "Mario, how could this happen?" "I don't know. I can't imagine him biting a child. This is awful." "I need to get back outside," said Mario as he finished tying Barron's leash to the eyelet screwed into the wall. Hearing the commotion, Shirley's parents had crossed the street and were assessing the injury when Mario returned to the scene. "It's okay, Mario. She'll be fine. It drew a little blood, but it's already stopped bleeding," said her father, Ray. "I'm so sorry. I'm just stunned. I can't believe that he bit Shirley. Why would he do that?" "Maybe Barron didn't like me holding John," said Shirley. "He bit me just as Mary Ellen gave him to me." "Barron loves John, but I can't imagine him biting you just for holding him. This is serious. I'll have to call the seeing eye tomorrow.
I'm sorry, Mary Ellen. I hope your ear is going to be all right. She'll be fine, Mario. We'll see you later, said Ray. The next morning, Mario called the seeing eye and reported the incident. You'll have to bring him back. Baron would be okay with somebody who didn't have any children, but you have a problem. Things have gone too far. When can you get to Morristown? For the second time within a year, Mario was forced to leave his work and family suddenly. He rescheduled court cases and found a temporary replacement judge. Losing the income from his law practice worried him, but he had no choice. He needed another dog. Once again, he said goodbye to Jane and the children and boarded the train for the long trip back to Morristown. The thought of saying goodbye to a dog he'd grown fond of was painful. Mario decided to lessen the sting by getting off the train early in New York City for a last fling together before returning to Morristown. On a bright early fall morning, they left Grand Central Station and walked down Fifth Avenue. He decided to get a little gift for Jane and went into a store. He had no idea which store he wandered into, although he could tell by the cool air and hushed atmosphere that it was likely a store with very expensive items. A clerk approached him and asked in icy tones, "May I help you?" "Yes, can you tell me the name of this store?" "Sir, you are in Tiffany's." Mario knew that he could not afford to buy anything at Tiffany's, but he wanted to save face, so he asked, "Which floor has the figurines?" He figured that he might be able to afford a little one. "They are on the third floor. Go straight back to the elevators, and someone will help you." The elevator doors closed behind them as Mario hesitated on the third floor, wondering which way he should go and hoping that Baron's tail wouldn't knock a pricey porcelain figure to the floor. "Sir, how may I help you?" asked another clerk, who eyed them suspiciously. "Yes, I'm looking for a small figurine for my wife." "Right this way, sir." The clerk took Mario's arm and steered them around the displays of expensive and fragile items. "I have a lovely china statue of a woman with a parasol. It's only $75. "Do you have anything cheaper than that?" "Our cheapest figurine is $29. But, sir, it's not nearly as attractive as the lady with the parasol." Mario knew that he couldn't afford to spend that much, approximately $335 adjusted for inflation, on a useless dust catcher. He thanked the clerk for his time and left, rather embarrassed at having wandered into such an exclusive store where he and Baron clearly did not belong. A little farther down the block, he tried again. This time he found a candy store where he bought a box of chocolates for Jane. Back out in the sunshine on the crowded sidewalks of Fifth Avenue, he continued his walk until it was time to return to the station and his final train ride with Baron. For the third time at the seeing eye, he anxiously awaited meeting his new companion. The handler finally brought an energetic young German shepherd named Uno, who happily licked his new master's hand. The seeing eye named each litter by the alphabet, so he was in the U litter. Mario wondered how they could come up with many new names starting with U, but accepted the Uno and began training. The duo worked well together and completed the training in only 2 weeks. Uno and Mario arrived in Muncie in early October 1948. Uno adjusted well to his new home, and Mario was glad to be bonding with a dog that wasn't distracted by children. Since he'd only had Baron for about 18 months, he didn't consider the dog to have been a match and didn't count him as one of his dogs. Including Baron, Mario owned 8 seeing eye dogs, although he always said that he'd only had 7 in his lifetime. Apparently, the seeing eye agreed with Mario. The school gave him a trophy with a sculpture of a German shepherd and a plaque that read, "The seeing eye celebrates with pride Mario Peroni and his 59 years of loving and working with 7 seeing eye dogs." Presented June 1st, 2001. Chapter 31, Helping Others. Besides his duties as judge of city court, Practicing law in the firm of Peroni and Peroni and raising a family, Mario was very active in helping handicapped children. He was a founder of the Delaware County chapter of the Indiana Society for Crippled Children and served in several capacities, including president in 1945. The organization sold Easter seals to raise money to provide services such as education for the homebound, disabled children usually didn't go to school, and money for medical care. They also provided crutches, braces, hearing aids, and wheelchairs to children. Fundraising letters with sheets of 100 colorful seals were mailed to residents around Easter. Recipients were encouraged to send back a donation and use the seals to close envelopes, thereby raising awareness of the plight of crippled children. Mario was chair of both the local and state Easter Seals campaign and helped to raise thousands of dollars. In 1945, the money raised by the Easter Seals campaign was used to open a special school for handicapped children, the Harry Mock School. 11 children with various disabilities were the first students taught in the well-equipped, cheerful basement of Jefferson Elementary. Without the leadership of the society, those children would not have had any formal education. Local schools were not accessible to handicapped children, and those teachers did not have the expertise to work with them. The children were forced to stay home, isolated and illiterate. If not for the Indiana School for the Blind, Mario would have been one of those children. But Mario wanted to do more than just raise money for the school. Once a week, he went on his lunch hour to teach Braille and offer encouragement to two visually impaired students. To celebrate Thanksgiving 1946, the local paper, the Muncie Star, sent a photographer to document the annual turkey luncheon at the school. Under the title, Thankful Though Blind, the picture depicts Mario and Carla standing next to a young blind boy with his lunch tray in the school cafeteria. Mario has his hand on the boy's shoulder. The caption quotes Mario as saying to the boy that handicapped persons, though unable to do some of the things their friends can accomplish, still have a great many things to be thankful for on this Thanksgiving Day. He added that a handicapped person should be thankful for the facilities of which he still has control and by using them to the best of his ability. And with the able assistance of his instructors, he can convert the handicap to an asset which he may use to serve himself and his community. The Muncie Junior Chamber of Commerce recognized Mario for his community service by awarding him the prestigious Outstanding Young Man of 1948 in a ceremony at the Masonic Temple Auditorium. An editorial appearing the next day in the Muncie Evening Press noted that when he was called to the speaker's platform, Mario Peroni stood straight and strong before some 500 men who had risen to their feet in a silent tribute. Tears came to the blinded eyes, and Judge Peroni could not have been living in darkness at that moment. He had heard that all of the fine young men considered, Judge Peroni had been the unanimous choice of the committee. The editorial then stated that it must have been the happiest moment in Judge Peroni's life, and his only regret that was my good wife wasn't there to share this honor with him. His prizes included a pin, a certificate, and a tobacco humidor. He accepted them graciously, but since he never smoked tobacco, he brought it home and laughingly gave it to Jane. The Eastern Indiana Notre Dame Club also honored him as the Notre Dame Man of the Year in 1949. The club presented him with a scroll recognizing his life and example, his devotion to family, his interest in civic affairs, his Catholic action, which proved him to be a Notre Dame man in the rich significances of moral, responsible leadership for which his Notre Dame training equipped him. Mario is beaming in the newspaper picture, standing next to a man holding the scroll that he would never be able to see. Believing that mental well-being was just as important as physical health, Mario didn't hesitate when asked to join with a group of citizens to form the Delaware County chapter of the Indiana Mental Hygiene Society. The group was front page news at the Muncie Star in January 1949, complete with a photo of the committee members, including Mario and his dog, Uno. The society worked to bring about public knowledge of mental illness, its causes, and treatment, with the goal of breaking through the stigma often associated with mental illness. Only 2 years later, the group opened the Child Guidance Center in Muncie to provide counseling for families and children. Although he often saw the worst in people, he still maintained hope for a better world. Mario was president of the Muncie chapter of the Optimist International in 1950. According to their website, the group is dedicated to providing hope and positive vision. Optimists bring out the best in youth, our communities, and ourselves, exhorting local members to give of their time and efforts to make a better world in which to live. Mario spent hours traveling and speaking to Optimist chapters around Indiana, giving speeches about his life. Newspaper articles detailing his speeches rarely mentioned how he traveled to those speaking engagements, but the Terre Haute Tribune photographer was at the train station when Mario, Jane, and Uno arrived on December 6, 1953, when their fourth child was just 4 months old. It must have been a special occasion for Jane to leave her children for a day trip to Terre Haute, since she rarely accompanied Mario to his civic talks. Jane was also a member of the Optimisses Club, the women's version of the Optimist International, and served in several leadership capacities, including president in 1959. Naturally a quiet person who usually preferred staying in the background at most social events, Jane ably led business meetings and introduced the monthly speakers. But one of her duties was to host the annual membership tea, and the Muncie Evening Press was there to take a photo of Jane and three other ladies who were gathered around the white tablecloth table laden with a punch bowl, flowers, and cookies. Jane is the only one not smiling in the photo. It must have been stressful for her to host the membership tea at her home. She constantly worried about the house being clean and neat, knowing that visitors would be very curious to see the inside of a blind woman's home. Jane was also featured as speaker at meetings for three organizations, the Newcomers Club, the Sorority Delta Theta Tau, and the Burris Mothers Club. The articles announced Jane as speaker, focused on naming those in attendance and describing the decorations. No information was given about Jane's subject matter, but presumably her topics included her experiences as a blind wife and mother. Chapter 32. Rita arrives and Mario is drafted. Holding the screaming baby, her third child, firmly to her chest, Jane maneuvered her way from the changing table to the crib. She hated the cluttered bedroom, which had been too small even for Anne and John. In addition to their twin beds, she'd barely managed to cram a changing table and crib into the space, leaving very little room for walking. If she tripped over a toy or lost her balance, Jane worried that her newborn, Rita Jane, would slip from her grip and fall. Sweat dripped from her face onto the baby's shoulder. Every window was open, but with no breeze, the unrelenting late July 1950 heat made the cramped bedroom feel even smaller. Rita whimpered as Jane bent over the crib, feeling the sheet for the right spot to lay her precious bundle. Rita quieted, and Jane exhaled a sigh of relief. She hoped that the baby could sleep in the hot room. As she turned on a small table fan, she heard 3-year-old John arguing with Anne in the living room. He needed his nap, but she was afraid that he'd wake up the baby. With only 2 bedrooms, juggling the needs of 3 young children was stressful. She decided to put John into her bed and lay down with him to help him sleep. When Jane and John awoke from their naps, Mario was home and listening to Anne read a book from the heat. Jane was not in a good mood. "Mario, we have to do something. I can't stand it anymore. We don't have room for three children in this house, Jane said as she leaned against the archway to the living room. Anne stopped reading and looked at each parent, not wanting to get involved in an impending argument. "And thanks for reading for me. Why don't you go outside and get some fresh air?" Relieved, Anne put down the book and skipped out of the living room. Turning to his wife, Mario said, "Now, Jane, it won't be much longer. My dad just can't throw those renters out of the house. We'll have to be patient. Mr. Johnson will move out as soon as his wife dies. There will be plenty of space then." "Your father is too nice. And why can't that old lady just die? She's had cancer forever. I'm tired of waiting. We need those three bedrooms. Anne and the baby can share a room, and John will have his own. It will make bedtime so much easier. And it's not safe now. That little room is so full of furniture, I can hardly walk in there. I'm afraid that I'll trip and drop Rita." "I know. I feel sorry for you. And I'm also sorry for poor Mrs. Johnson. They lived two doors down on the other side of your parents' house for 3 years, and they've never been friendly. I don't feel sorry for her. I hoped that we would be in our new house before Rita was born. There's a lot of painting and wallpapering that needs to be done. Now we'll have to stay in here till that work is finished. I just can't have three kids in this house while they're painting." "No, we can't live while they're painting, but we're okay here for now. At least we have a roof over our heads." "It may be fine for you. You aren't here 24 hours a day in the heat, trying to cook and clean and change diapers. And now, not knowing when we can move makes it even harder. I can't even get the painters lined up." "Now, Jane, you shouldn't wish that poor woman to die any faster. We'll just have to be patient." "Well, I can't wait for that extra half bath in the third bedroom. All the rooms are so much bigger than what we have now. I'm going to need an interior designer to help me with colors. Anne is too young to help, and I don't want your mother's opinion. At least I can decide on paint colors and start thinking about where to put the furniture." When the unfortunate neighbor passed away in late August 1950, Jane happily began planning the move. With help from a designer, Jane decided on a medium shade of green paint for the living room and dining rooms. Wall-to-wall carpet was de rigueur in the 1950s. Mario and Jane liked it because it absorbed sound, thus reducing annoying echoes. Area rugs were dangerous, and Jane didn't want to worry about tripping over them, so she had carpet everywhere, up the kitchen, breakfast rooms, and bathrooms. Ever practical, Jane chose a beige carpet. It went with the furniture and wouldn't show dog hair. The renovations were finished in October. Jane hired movers to carry the furniture and boxes the short distance, two houses away. Aletta watched the children while Antonio directed the furniture placement. Even Anne helped by carrying her toys to her new room. Jane loved their new house. The extra bathroom saved steps and arguments, and John, now almost 4 years old, was happy to have his own bedroom. Anne shared a room with baby Rita, but she didn't mind sharing. Her new room was larger, and she liked having space for her books. Jane worked hard to decide where to put every item in the house. She was a firm believer in a place for everything and everything in its place. If she wanted something, she needed to know where to find it. If it wasn't put back in its proper place, it was much more difficult for her to find. She couldn't just look at a shelf and pick up an item. If it wasn't there, she had to use her hands to feel around, often missing what she was looking for. Surprisingly, Jane was so good at remembering where she placed things that she rarely wasted time trying to find something. "Put it back where you found it," was repeated often in the household, and even Mario didn't dare disobey the rule. While Jane was busy with the children and settling into the house, Mario continued to practice law and entered his third year as city judge. He became even more active in the Democratic Party and was drafted to run for mayor in the May 1951 primary. He planned on running for re-election for judge, but party leaders were concerned with the corruption in the incumbent Democrat mayor's office. They convinced Mario, with his honest and good reputation, that he would be the perfect candidate. prominent Muncie leaders joined in assuring him that they would donate money and time to his campaign. Flattered, Mario bowed to their pressure. Without consulting Jane, and just 8 months after the birth of their third child, Mario decided that running for mayor would be his opportunity to rid the city of corruption. Jane was furious about his unilateral decision. How dare he make such an important commitment without her? She remembered the many nights when he was out making speeches or attending rubber chicken dinners campaigning for judge in 1947. Now she had three young children, including Rita, who, as a toddler, required constant attention. She had to focus and be mindful of what the children were doing at every moment. She couldn't visually see a misdeed and correct a child. She had to stop what she was doing, walk over, find the child, check their hands, and feel around the area to investigate what they were doing. Anne helped with the younger children, but she was in school on weekdays. Raising three children and doing all the household chores without help was exhausting. She needed Mario home at night, but all too often he was campaigning for an office that she didn't want him to win. Jane dreaded the thought of going to endless political dinners and ceremonies. Aside from the difficulty of having a suitable wardrobe and arranging transportation to events, she found it hard to chat in a noisy environment. She couldn't catch someone's eye to initiate conversation. She worried about being stuck on a chair, alone and isolated in a room full of laughing people. Jane couldn't move around an unfamiliar room by herself. She was dependent upon someone else to walk with her. If she needed to use the restroom, it was embarrassing to have to locate and ask another woman to accompany her there. Social functions were stressful, and she much preferred to be at home with the children. As the campaign progressed, it became apparent that some people did not want the mayor's office to be cleaned up. Jane became concerned for Mario's safety, especially after an anonymous phone threat. The caller had said that he knew he walked home every day and where he lived. Jane was frightened. What would she do if something happened to Mario? How could she raise three children alone without any way to make a living for herself? Mario was less concerned about his own personal safety. He thought that the caller just wanted to get him out of the race and wouldn't follow through. He continued his campaign, giving frequent radio talks and attending events. His work earned him a May primary victory, beating the incumbent mayor by a 3-1 margin. He stepped up the pace for the fall election, but couldn't heal the scars from the primary. He was soundly beaten in the GOP landslide that year, as almost every Republican on the ballot was elected to local offices. Disappointed by the loss, he concentrated on his law practice, which had grown to include three partners, and did not pursue another public office for 20 years. Jane was quite relieved at the outcome, although it was difficult for her to comfort her husband. She couldn't change the results, nor did she wish that it had been different. She assumed that Mario would be home more in the evenings, but instead of politicking, he resumed the old habit of walking next door after dinner to visit his parents. Jane's relief quickly turned into irritation as once again she was abandoned at night to manage the children. We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.